Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Prettier days we've had yesterday and today. Sunshine. Hi, Veronica. It's John Williams. Here until noon on WGN, the days have been, last couple, a little prettier, a little sunnier, a little bluer skies, but not warm yet. My wife and my two dogs still live in Minnesota. We're moving. It was 80 degrees yesterday in Minneapolis. 80 degrees!
80 in Minneapolis?
Yeah.
I thought it was supposed to be cold.
No, not it's supposed to. No, you know what it is? It's supposed to be warmer here. That's
yeah,
the deal.
Yeah, that's true.
I want my money back. Incidentally, it's a big sports weekend. Sam told you about the, what is it, two most exciting minutes in sports?
Most exciting, fastest. Yeah, you could pretty much shave it however you want. It's 2 minutes. It's horses, 20 of them, and a $2 million purse. You get the bugle, if you're a bugle guy, you know, the trumpet. There's a one-eyed horse actually running today, and his name is Patch.
Yeah, that's a great story. And, you know, the horse is missing his left eye, so the one that would be on the rail as he's coming around.
So he won't see any other horses?
No. Well, if he was on the rail, he wouldn't see any horses because he'd be on the rail.
Yes.
But if he was on the outside, you're right. Maybe that's a good thing, huh? If he's on the outside, coming around the bend,
turn it up! I do love those horse race announcers. They are wild.
They come home. Honey, I'm home. I was in the driveway. Now I'm at the door.
Jimmy, turn it down.
Honey, you're not at work now. We need to use our inside voice. You know, the two most exciting hours in sports took place yesterday at the Monza Formula One track in Italy. They tried to see if humans could run a sub-2-hour marathon. And I love this story, too. They don't exactly have the pomp and ceremony of this as they do at the Kentucky Derby. But what a fascinating story that is. And I just saw it as a little story in the Wall Street Journal this week. So I got up this morning to see if we had a new world record in the marathon and if humankind had broken the two-hour barrier. You know, it was a big deal to see if we could get below 4 minutes on the mile. It was a big deal to see if we could get past, oh, say, under 10 seconds on the 100-meter dash, etc. The world record for the marathon was about 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds. So figure it was almost 2 hours and 3 minutes. And they got a few world-class elite marathoners. They gave them new special Nike shoes. This was a stunt, a promotional thing that Nike did. They got them a climate-controlled track. Well, as much as they could control the climate. That is, it was a special track, and they pick the day and time that they thought the weather would be most accommodating. And so that was this morning at 5:47. And these three guys ran a race. They did things that actually discount it from being an official marathon record. For instance, instead of grabbing water bottles off the table, mopeds would come up to them and give them the water bottles so they wouldn't even have to reach over to the table. It was all about the stride. It was all about running. They had pacers, too. A guy from Chicago was one of the pacers who would run with them for, say, 5 kilometers so that they would have the exact perfect pace. So it's not the way you normally run the Chicago Marathon or the Boston Marathon, but it was still a guy running unaided for 26.2 miles. And they tried to get it under 2 hours. While they shattered the world record by over 2 minutes, they did not break the 2-minute barrier. If, in fact, over the 26 miles, they had run just under 1 second faster per mile, they would have broken 2 hours. If they had gone 1 second per mile faster, they would have been under. I don't know if that's going to keep these guys up at night because it was still 22 seconds over 2 hours. But you think about it, they were that close.
Do it again. Line up. Do it again.
Yeah, my coach would have said, all right, Williams, you didn't get there. Line up. Let's go. Let's go.
Instead of suicides, run the marathon again.
Bill Drew, he's going to do it. He did it. You can do it. Come on.
I thought you would try his name since you won't, I will. Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya.
Eliud Kipchoge.
Yep.
Gazoonite. So that's just kind of a cool story today. You have the Kentucky Derby. You had that. By the way, so just one other note about that.
You know, I was going to make one other note, too. If you get me a climate-controlled track.
Here we go. Here we go. What number are you looking at there,
Griff?
We just
babied these runners into a two-hour mile. Or two-hour. I could also do a two-hour mile, but a two-hour marathon.
Yeah, no, that's you're mistaken, Griff. You're thinking of the mile in 2 hours. In fact, that, I believe, Griff, do the homework on this. I believe they averaged a sub-5-minute mile for 26 miles. I think they ran 4-something. I've sort of done the math on this before, and in fact, they run for 26.2 miles faster than almost all of humanity can run 100 yards. Their pace is faster than you and I could run the length of a football field. They just, they go. So it begs the question, well then, what is the fastest that anybody will ever run the 100 meters or the 100 yards? And does there come a point where humankind can no longer? It's going to get boring. Track and field and marathons and cross country, it's all going to get boring because it's really interesting now, isn't it? But it's going to get boring if we get to a point where you can never break the record. Human beings can't go any farther or faster. The long jump record is 29 feet, 4 1/4 inches. Measure that with your kids and just pause at the wonder of that. But that was set in 1991, 29 feet, 4 1/4. The mile record is 3 hours and 43 minutes. No, 3 minutes and 43 seconds. Can you believe that? That it's now 3 minutes and 43 seconds. But that was set in 1999. The 100-meter dash record is 9.58, set in 09. The 100-yard dash is 9.07. Wow. Set in 2010. And the high jump, set in 1993, notice none of these were yesterday, the high jump is now 8 feet, 1/2 inch. Now take the tape measure and measure along the wall 8 feet and 1/2 inch with the kids and say a human being unaided jumped over that. How awesome is that? There was a story that we talked about briefly on the show this week that I just wanted to bring back to your attention. Did you see the editorial written in the paper Thursday? This is a Thursday, May 4th, Chicago Tribune editorial. Why schools should teach cursive. Why schools should teach cursive. And the editorial was written in longhand. They actually wrote it out or had a font that looked like they wrote it out. And then they talk about how the Illinois House would like to reverse a trend. The Illinois House recently passed a bill obligating every public school to teach cursive. Alabama passed a similar law last year in kinship with 13 other states and the city of New York's public school system. The Illinois measure would be a favor to students who would get a grounding in a skill. I'm reading from the Tribune editorial now that offers, hold on a second, that offers intellectual value as well as aesthetic merits. Cursive is a special form of self-expression. A graceful hand is an asset in writing thank you notes and love letters, which just aren't the same in a uniform font. There are all sorts of occasions when the ability to put words down in flowing script comes in handy. They say it's a measure of your intellect and it's a measure of your personality. We should teach cursive. And my first inclination when reading this was, no, we really don't need to. You just don't need to. That's us just wishing that Marshall Fields was still on State Street. Times have passed us by, and it's time to go with the flow. I'm not even sure we need to teach kids multiplication anymore. But you don't have to, beyond your signature, teach cursive. As long as you know the what A through Z looks like and you know how to spell, your block or cursive writing will work. It will work. And you just don't need cursive that much. The only time where you really are ashamed of your cursive, where you miss not having better cursive, and I'm speaking to you if you're under the age of 30, is when you sign a check or when you sign anything. When you put your signature down, you look like you are in kindergarten. You look like you've learned English as a foreign language. I have two sons who are well-educated, and their handwriting is amazingly bad. And their signatures, that stamp of self-expression, that physical layout of ink that says, this is who I am, is underwhelming. Now, those of us who grew up in an era where your handwriting mattered sort of took a little pride in what that looked like. But these kids these days, they don't seem to care what their signature says about them.
Okay, so are we learning cursive or not, according to you?
Right.
You're trying to have it both ways.
I really am. I'm expressing to you the value of your signature. Well, here's the point, Griff. I want us all to have legible handwriting, number one. I'm not sure the schools need to teach that. You can learn that on your own. I mean, really, it's just a matter of practice. You know what an S in cursive looks like. Now, just do some of that. But I also think that I'm just, as a favor to society, reminding you that your signature does matter. Now, should we take time away from the STEM program or art or physical education to teach cursive? No. But your handwriting matters. Am I right about this? 10:24 on WGN. This is John Williams. The news at the bottom of the hour. Francis Macron in the USA Today, today says presidential campaign has been hacked. So there's just two candidates, and now they are saying that there has been a hack in their election just before they go to vote tomorrow. FBI Director James Comey has said, je ne sais quoi. More about that later on. Okay, I asked you if cursive is important anymore. Audrey, you're on line one. You're on WGN. Hi, Audrey, how are you?
Well, good morning, John.
Morning.
LaGrange misses you.
Thank you for that. I miss LaGrange and LaGrange Park.
All right, but you are wrong, sir, on the penmanship thing. My granddaughter yesterday had a three-hour test. Don't remember the name of the test. Three of the questions were essays. This is an honor roll student. She was very concerned about her penmanship, that it would not, in fact, affect her grade because she has poor penmanship. So these kids better worry about it.
Well, or they should let her, or why didn't they give her a keyboard? Couldn't she have typed it out?
No, it was to be written in longhand.
Yeah.
At LT.
Audrey, thanks for the call. We go from Audrey to Lynn. Lynn, you're on WGN. What do you want to say?
Hi. Yeah, when I was in school, we moved between second and third grade. The school we moved to had taught it in second grade. The school we moved from wasn't teaching it till third grade, and I missed it. And there's something to be said for that eye-hand coordination and small motor control that the practice gives you when you're young, to just sort of put that whole body, mind, eye thing together that cursive helps you with.
Oh.
And so I don't have it.
But it's more important than just writing. It's hand-eye coordination. It's brain-hand coordination, huh?
There's a lot that goes together with it. And in grade school especially, you're supposed to be learning skills then. You're not supposed content comes after you have the skills.
Yep. You know, that's an interesting point. Thank you for the call, Lynn. I'm glad you joined us. You remember when you learned to tie your shoes and how complicated that was for a child. And in fact, if you watch yourself or somebody tie their shoe, there's a lot going on there. The dexterity that you and I demonstrate is pretty remarkable. You could do it blindfolded. But you had to learn that once upon a time. Michelle, what did you want to say? You're on the air.
A coworker in his mid-20s whose signature is just his printed name. First time I saw it, I gave it back to him and said, you didn't sign this, you just printed. He's like, no, that's my signature.
Literally, he doesn't have a cursive signature.
He does not write cursive, it's just printed.
And why not? Does he not know how, or he doesn't like it?
I'm not sure. I mean, he came to the U.S. when he was 7 or 8. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but his signature is printed. I don't think he knows how to write cursive.
Michelle, thanks for the call. And I don't think he's alone. I think there's kids born and raised in the USA are just like that. Sheila, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. My grandson is 12 years old. He's an honor roll student. He got a letter from his aunt in Texas, who is an ex-nun, who has beautiful penmanship. He said, I can't read this, Nana. It's in cursive.
He doesn't know how to read cursive?
No.
So if you're 12, you're what, eighth grade, something like that?
No, you're in sixth, going into seventh.
Wow.
It's kind of scary, isn't it?
I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, really, now that you mention it, while I'm saying that I'm not convinced that you have to have perfect cursive, you have to be able to read it. It is our language. I mean, there you are looking at the Declaration of Independence. You don't know what that says. We go from you to line five, and that's Nancy. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, John. I have a comment similar to a previous caller. I work in a place where I have to obtain signatures from people. And when it's a younger person, I hand them the paper, they hand it back to me, print it. I'm like, no, I need your signature. That is my signature. And some of the most beautiful handwriting I've ever seen comes from people in their 70s and 80s and beyond. So it's just kind of sad. And I do agree about people not being able to read. If you don't learn to write it, you're not going to be able to read. And there's things you won't be able to read if you don't learn cursive. So cursive! But you're probably right, Dad. No, but you know what? It probably is true, though, that maybe you could learn it. You know, I don't know if people will take it up to learn it by themselves, but you can, you know, and might not be.
Right. I'm not sure who's going to teach it. The churches, I don't know where we're going to learn cursive now, but and we have so much to do. I mean, frankly, you've now got to learn if your options were an internet class. Or a cursive class, where do you think the student's time would be better spent? Honestly, I'm as interested in the ego of the thing, though. Don't you look at your signature and go, hey, that's me. That's me. And I think that must be lost on these people that are printing it. It's 1029. It's 1038. Thank you, Veronica. This is John Williams here until 12 noon. You can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 on WGN. Bob Newhart's going to be in town. When you think of Bob Newhart, don't you think of Chicago a little bit? Don't you see or feel closer to him than maybe you do some other sitcom stars from the 70s or 80s just because of his show? I sure do. Well, in fact, he is from Chicago. He's an Oak Park kid. He went to school in Chicago, and he's coming back to town for the Salvation Army annual civic luncheon, and he's going to be the keynote speaker. So I called him before the show. He'll be in town next weekend, but I called him this week to ask him, you know, what's he going to talk about, and just to catch up. I welcomed him to WGN.
I'm well familiar with it.
Now, how do you know WGN Radio? I mean, I know you're a Chicago guy.
Wally Phillips and Brick House. I mean, that's going back years and years
sure,
and years.
Sure, sure. You know, I was Wally Phillips' intern once upon a time.
Oh, boy.
So that's my claim to fame.
What a great guy, yeah.
After being able to say I talked to Bob Newhart, too. Thank you for joining us. I understand that you're going to be the keynote speaker at the Salvation Army Annual Civic Luncheon.
In researching, I found out something I didn't know, and that's that of the 50 best charities, they have a service that ranks the best charities. They were number six.
So you're going to be the keynote speaker. What kind of shtick or monologue or message do you have planned?
Just pretty much talking about coming back to Chicago and the Cubs. You know, I was a Cub fan since I was 6 years old.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have
that.
A picture of my mother taking me to Wrigley Field. Yeah. And, you know, hung in there. I know when the Cubs were playing the Dodgers in the playoffs, and it was 5-3, top of the ninth, and the Dodgers were ahead. So I'm watching it, and I go, oh, my God. The Cubs get up, get two guys on base and a home run, and now it's 6-5. And now they're bringing Chapman. And Chapman strikes out the side with his 105-mile-an-hour fastball. So I sent an email to Max Berman, who's in charge of communications PR for the Cubs. And I said, Max, please, will you please talk to the Cubs? I'm 87 years old. I can't take this. Can you please have them score more runs early on?
It was hard on us, too.
I can't take it. So they sent me a W flag, and then at the end of each game, I'd send him a picture of me holding up. One time I was in Seattle with my grandkids up there, and the Cubs won that game against Cleveland. And so we have a picture of the kids, my three grandkids, and me holding up the W flag.
Oh, that's funny. You know, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think we all, regardless of our age, went through that. And I'll tell you a short story. My son is 27 at the time, and for some of the games, he would walk up and down the street. He couldn't bear to watch it on TV. It was so he'd go up and down the street, and he'd look into people's living rooms and catch the score and then just kind of move on. But it was just, it was too hard to sit there and take it, you know?
I know that feeling. I'll tell you a story. I was doing the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson at NBC, and so the next soundstage was Richard Pryor. He was doing a TV show.
Yeah.
And his guest was John Belushi. So I'm in my dressing room, you know, waiting to go on with Johnny. And comes a knock at the door. I open it. It's John Belushi. He said, "I'm John Belushi." I said, "I know who you are, John. I think you're doing a marvelous job. And, you know, on Saturday Night Live." And he said, "Do you remember a Cub game you were at, maybe 10 years ago? And a bunch of kids came up and asked for your autograph between innings?" I said, yeah, my wife and I, yeah. He said, "I was one of those kids."
Not funny. Did you go to the World Series games in person?
No, I couldn't. I couldn't. I was trying to get there in 2014, because that was the 100th anniversary of Wrigley Field. But it didn't work out. I couldn't get into Chicago. It's still one of the great cities. I have a statue at Navy Pier. For a while, they had it on Michigan Avenue. I thought to myself, you know, if someone had told me when I was going to Loyola University in the 50s,
yeah,
if someone, you know, I'm walking down Michigan Avenue, because I used to walk all the time from the Loop to, you know, to Lewis Towers, and if someone had said, you know, there's going to be a statue of you here on Michigan Avenue, I would have gone to the nearest policeman and said, "You better arrest this guy, because he's demented." You know, obviously.
You have the perfect Chicago resume: Oak Park, St. Ignatius, Loyola. You got a degree in business management at Loyola, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Did you not think you had a shot at being an entertainer when you were getting a business degree?
Oh, not realistically. No, not at all.
Do you ever look at your Wikipedia page?
Not in a long time, though. No.
It's lovely. You'll enjoy it. It says here, George Robert Bob Newhart, born September 5th, 1929, is an American stand-up comedian and actor, noted for his deadpan and slightly stammering delivery. He came to prominence in the 1960s when his album of comedic monologues, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, became a worldwide bestseller and reached number one on the Billboard Pop Album Chart. It remains the 20th best-selling comedy album in history, and the follow-up album, The Button-Down Mind Strikes Back, was a massive success also, and the two albums held the Billboard number one and number two positions simultaneously.
There's another story that goes along with that. I had the number one album. My first album became number one. Then my second album became number two, but then the second album became number one, and my first album became number two. And it was like I had the number one and number two album for 20 weeks or something. I forget what it was. And my daughter called me up. She was in the music business. And she said, "Dad, you had a record that just got broken." And I said, "What was that?" And she said, "Well, you had the number one and number two album and for 20 weeks. I said, "Oh, I didn't know that." She said, "Yeah." I said, "Who broke it?" She said, "Axl Rose. Guns N' Roses." And I said, "Well, at least it went to a friend, you know."
Yeah.
I mean, Ax and I talk, I just got off the phone with that.
I do not believe that, sir. And in fact, it says here, noted for his deadpan and stammering delivery, and we all know your delivery style. And I wondered, where did you get the confidence? Because if that really is your natural delivery or style, I would think that would keep a man from thinking that I could control an audience just standing there by myself.
I got out of service and I worked as an accountant for 2 years, and then I realized that isn't what I wanted to do. In my case, I said, I'll give it a shot, and if it doesn't work out, then it didn't work out.
I know this is a long time ago, but was there a joke you told or a moment, maybe on a small stage, where you thought, wow, I think I can do this?
Charlie was in Houston at a club called the Tidelands. It was the very first. I'd never played a nightclub before. I walked out on stage with all the bravado I could muster because I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. But you have to. That's the first thing you learn is you better look like you know what you're doing. Yeah. Otherwise, you're dead meat. So I was kind of slow at first, and then I got that first laugh, and then I got the second laugh, and then it was like, yeah, I guess I am good at this.
Yeah, they're laughing with me.
Yeah.
Do people just thank you sometimes for your body of work over the years?
John, that's the nicest thing about it. You become part of people's lives, you know, and it's that's a wonderful feeling to just feel like you've meant something to somebody.
Hello?
Bob Newhart speaking in Chicago. This coming weekend, he'll be the, not master of ceremonies, I guess the keynote speaker. He's the entertainment for the Salvation Army's annual Civic Luncheon. It'll actually be Friday at the Hilton downtown. And there he goes, catching the L, heading south. And then you see the L heading north. Kind of get the feeling the L's just doing circles around the loop, and he's going for a ride. But then he comes home, and there's Suzanne Fleshette, oh my. So it's interesting, isn't it, that he goes the 20 years. I think it was the difference in time between when he had the one and two albums for 20 weeks, and it goes from the button-down mind of Bob Newhart to Axl Rose, Guns N' Roses, Sweet Child of Mine. Okay, so just to show you the difference in times and eras, that's Guns N' Roses. They eclipse Bob Newhart. Here's a segment from Bob Newhart's button-down mind of Bob Newhart. He is the driving instructor, and he has just gotten into the car, and he's talking to the woman who he's about to give a lesson to.
You're Mrs. Webb, is that right? Oh, I see you've had one lesson already. Who is the instructor on that, Mrs. Webb? I'm sorry, here it is, Mr. Adams. Just let me read ahead and kind of familiarize myself with the case. How fast were you going when Mr. Adams jumped from the car? 75? And where was that? In your driveway. How far had Mr. Adams gotten in the lesson? Backing out.
Bob Newhart's button-down mind. 10:49. This is WGN. 10:50. I'll be calling you later. 10:53 on WGN. This is John Williams. So Sam Panayotovich mentioned a little while ago in news. We've got news coming up in about 7 minutes. Today's Kentucky Derby Day. 5:46. If you don't want to watch it all, 5:46 this evening is when the horses will go off. And then Sunday, it's the Yankees and the Cubs on ESPN. We are again the national game. Hopefully it'll go better than last night. I mean, that's painful. We're up 2-0 in the ninth, two outs. We give up a 3-run home run and lose 3-2 to the Yankees. The Yankees are in town. By the way, on Sports Illustrated's website today, they have a pretty funny piece about the Cubs and the Yankees. And in part it says, this is from John Taylor. He said, there's been a lot of buzz over the first few weeks of the season about the Yankees rookie right fielder Aaron Judge. Have you seen this guy? He is bigger than all but 50 players in the NFL. He's gigantic. He's bigger than Gronkowski. He's this man-child.
If you know who I'm talking about, Griffin, this fella, Aaron Judge, he's enormous. In fact, they write about him this way. A gargantuan hulk of a man who stands 6'7 and weighs nearly 300 pounds and has made hash of opposing pitching so far. He's got 5 home runs already this season. And oh, what majestic shots those home runs have been. Long, arcing, massive blows delivered by a man who looks like he was carved out of a mountainside. Prodigious blasts that shake the earth as they land 450 feet or more from home plate. Behold just one of them, a colossal dinger off of White Sox rookie Dylan Covey that may as well have been shot out of a cannon. Judge is very large, and much has been made already of his massive size, particularly when he's paired with teammate Ronald Torres, an infielder who stands all of 5'8", nearly a foot below Judge, and weighs just 151 pounds. Together, they make for a delightful pastiche of absurdity. The giant slugger and his tiny shortstop friend gaze upon Judge and Torres high-fiving after a homer and try not to laugh. The combination of Judge's size and age, he turns 25 in a few days, leads to a daunting sobriquet. MLB's large adult son. A large adult son is exactly what it sounds like. A young man who is also magnificently big. SB Nation's Matt Ufford penned an ode to Judge that includes the lines, "Our large adult baseball son, the beefy adolescent gigantling who is still swatting baseballs into orbit with uprooted redwoods." For me, though, John Taylor writes, Judge cannot be baseball's large adult son, and there's one simple reason for that. He lacks the overall goofiness that such a title requires. You see, a true large adult son isn't just a young man of oversized proportions. He's also a galoot, a big boy, a bit of a lummox who nonetheless provides joy to all who know him. He's the kind of guy everyone calls Spud or Bubba, the quintessential large adult son. Has food stains on him at all times, and the kind of haircut that suggests that he goes to the barber shop with no plans. As such, Judge is large and strapping. He's a carnival strongman, carrying a woman on each bicep or swinging an oversized hammer over and over again for no particular reason. Judge is the metal from a meteorite sculpted into a statue of Hercules that was brought to life and given a baseball bat. But he's too fit, he's too built, too imposing to embody the all-around aw shucks personality that is the large adult son. No, in baseball, there is another who deserves to be MLB's large adult son, a player who is the title's platonic ideal. I refer, of course, to the Cubs left fielder Kyle Schwarber. How can anyone be said to match Schwarber in terms of being a big, beefy boy? Schwarber is the pinnacle of the large adult son in baseball, a man who looks like his diet is equal parts gas station sandwiches and frozen fish sticks that have not fully cooked. Schwarber is built like a 1950s refrigerator and has the facial hair of a Las Vegas auto mechanic who is also the bassist for a Motley Crue cover band. His defense is sloppy and misguided, but it's also energetic and endearing. His oafishness, though, is matched by an untamed strength that punishes pitchers. Through his heft and whip-like swing, he clobbers baseballs and sends them to places that we never could have imagined. I don't know for sure, he writes, if Schwarber has all the hallmarks of a large adult son, if he says gosh all the time, or if he has at any point owned a big mouth Billy Bass, but to deny him his large adult son title is to look past the obvious. Aaron Judge is a monster made of flesh. Kyle Schwarber is the big boy mascot, but also really good at socking homers. I'm looking at the 10-day forecast, Veronica.
Yeah, it's pretty nice, isn't it?
Well, we do have some sunshine coming our way, but here are your high temperatures, 52, 51, 59, 58, 55, 58. Do the Bears play next weekend? 63, 58, 63.
Ooh, 63 is nice.
I'm sorry. I want 80.
Yeah, me too.
81, 82, 83.
Yeah, I'll take it. I'm already gardening.
Here are the high temperatures for Abu Dhabi. 104, 100, 101, 104, 106, 104.
No, thanks.
But you got to live in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
I still have that.
But
on
it's
my
a dry
phone.
Heat, John.
My sister lived there for a while, so I always put the temperatures or the, you know, weather pages on my phone of my family wherever they are. So I've kind of got this collection of. She doesn't live there anymore, but I keep that on there. So I have like my folks are in Tucson half the year. And, so it's kind of a my son went to school in Indianapolis. I have Indianapolis on there. So it's sort of a roadmap of where my family's been, my weather. And we do not have much warm weather coming to Chicago for the next week or more. It's 11:10. Okay, so on Saturdays at this time, hi, it's John Williams. We do something called the Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast. We record a podcast with Eric Zorn, the snarky columnist for the Chicago Tribune, sometimes Kristen McQuarrie, sometimes Scott Stantis, the editorial cartoonist, and our own Steve Bertrand. Rob Martier's been known to make a cameo appearance in the Mincing Rascals. We do this podcast, and you can get it online at WGNradio.com, WGNplus.com. Wherever you subscribe to your finer podcasts, you can get the Mincing Rascals. So this week, we were mincing about some of the things that happened in the news, and there sure was a lot. Early in the week, much of the conversation on the radio was about Hillary Clinton saying that she would have won were it not for James Comey's letter. And then there was conversation about Hillary Clinton. In talking about Hillary Clinton, Scott Stantis says,
I think she's running again. I truly do. I think.
Wait.
No, I get scoffed at this all the time.
Yes,
but look at what she's doing. Look at what she has said and what she's leading up to. She also said after her talk at the Women for Women International Conference that she's now part of the resistance. She's going to resist and be part of that.
I've been listening to Elizabeth Warren. She's out pushing a book. She is so much better spoken than
she already said. She's not running in 2020.
I know she says she's not running in 2020, but that's just what you say. You hope she does. You hope Elizabeth Warren
does
doesn't.
Not.
She's really, I think she's really good.
What about Al Franken?
Goofy. I think she's goofy, and I think a battle between her and Donald Trump would be even worse than the one we had with Hillary Clinton. I'm fatigued thinking about it. No,
all he has against her is that she's Pocahontas.
I know. I don't know if we need to dwell on that, but this is an example of anybody else says that. There's a price to pay. Donald Trump says that, and we say, oh, that's Donald Trump. He's the president of the United States
and he's using
used Pocahontas as a pejorative.
A second-grade schoolyard taunt.
You know, really, you almost have to stop and think about that. It's remarkable.
But we don't stop and think about it, because you're right, because it's just got new weird.
What's the next tweet?
Well, there's this whole other layer of how you cover him and what you say about him, because it's never been done before. It's on a different level, right?
I mean, his behavior. Generally?
His behavior, his language. I mean, look, he welcomed the Air Force football team to the White House and turned it into a political speech. He did it the Easter egg roll. Washington.
Well, he's got campaign ads, which CNN will not run, by the way, because in the campaign ad, he's got a video now that they wanted CNN to run, and in it they show Wolf Blitzer and it says fake news. And CNN said, we're not going to run that. And then the White House said, see, that's the problem. They're trying to control the narrative.
And going back to the Hillary thing, by the way, the fact that she appointed her own lackey to head the DNC, I mean, she's positioning herself to run again. Everyone says she's so old. She's a same age as Donald Trump, who clearly, as you just mentioned, is running for re-election. He already has a re-election campaign committee.
I can't tell you how small the enthusiasm is going to be in the Democratic Party to watch a third run for president from Hillary Clinton.
She's the William Jennings Bryant of her generation.
Campaign 2020.
Not 3 years. 3 years and 9 months.
Theme song.
Talk to me about health care, guys. So it looks like we're going to get a new version of the ACA. I guess a better version of that is better.
This isn't from what I can read, from what we can glean, and it's one of those instances where you're going to have to pass it in order to read it. I don't know that this is an improvement.
It's being passed because of the political expedience. They don't want to go home for the summer not having done it. We're past the 100-day margin anyway.
They want to vote on it so they don't even go home for the couple-week break and take heat from the
And I'm a little discouraged
meetings.
By
the
that.
The outrage in the districts is not that they haven't repealed and replaced Obamacare. Obamacare is more popular than it's ever been, and this repeal proposal has like 17% approval. The earlier one, this one, which is harsher, is probably going to have a worse CBO score. They're not going to even wait for the CBO score. They're not going to debate it. I don't think they're even going to read it. I do not understand the rush here. They've had 6 or 7 years to come up with a plan to agree on something. They couldn't do it. They've been floundering around, and then suddenly they've got to do this before their vacation, and they're going to get hammered by it. I actually think that they're stepping on a rake here, and the Democrats are secretly happy about this because they're going to be able to, as Nancy Pelosi said, they're going to tattoo this bill on the foreheads of every Republican congressman who's running in a close district in 2018. This is going to be a disaster for them.
You agree
the
with
way
that, Scott?
The way Obamacare was a disaster.
Well, I think you're. I'm not sure if you're being purposely naive or not, Eric. But I mean, of course you know why they're pushing it.
It's no, I think he's doing it all by himself.
No, you, of course you know why they're pushing it quickly, because they don't want people to read it. It's the same reason that Obamacare wasn't read
after 15 months.
Yeah, well, Obamacare, they took some time with it. I mean,
a little bit, and you're right. Yeah. And they waited for the CBO, and this is they're not waiting for CBO because we all know in this room, Republican, Democrat, or Independent, what the CBO report's going to say. It's going to say the exact same thing that the earlier version of Trump Care said.
So what, do we dismiss that? I mean, aren't you
no, you don't dismiss it.
In that?
I'm saying we know why they're shoving it through, and you have to call BS when it's BS, and this is it.
If we can have Elif play the soundbite when they were rushing Obamacare.
If you rush this thing through before anybody even knows what it is, that's not good democracy. That's not doing our work for our constituents. What's wrong with going home for August, having town hall meetings, listening to our constituents, and then coming back in September and doing this right?
So there it is. And what about that, Eric?
Well, the hypocrisy here, the Republicans were talking, one of their big objections to Obamacare, they had three. One was that it was passed, it was rammed through. They always said it's rammed down American people's throats. It's changed 1/6 of the economy done purely on a partisan basis. This bill is only getting Republican votes. They said that you had to that they were criticizing Nancy Pelosi for saying you had to read the bill before you had to pass it before you knew it was in it. They didn't get this bill until 8 o'clock. Hardly any of them have read it. And further, they don't have a CBO score. And they were saying all along that this is their brand. The Republican brand is that we're responsible with your money. We know what bills are going to cost before we pass them. All those things are out the window. I really don't know what. I mean, my naivete here is actually genuine. I don't see the political calculus here except this very short-term victory that Trump can claim and that Paul Ryan can claim. Like, they did something.
All right, wait a minute. What's the matter, Scott?
Oh, I'm just looking. I'm thinking it's always short-term. Always short-term now in politics. There are no statesmen. They're gone, dead, buried. No one thinks past 2 years
from
now.
That's true.
2018 commercial. Promises made. Promises kept. Joe Blow, yeah. Republican.
They were holding
for
up
Congress.
That sign.
Yeah, 2018 commercial.
Hopefully
Joe
the people...
Blow, Republican. He had 136,000 people in his district lost health care.
Right. Scott's ad will be a Democrat ad. They'll have someone in an iron lung watching it.
That's pretty good. Right?
Well, so what do you have there? You've got some statistics.
So, you know, I'm not very good on the source of this, but Steve Ratner, who is a guy who I watch a lot on TVs, he helped foster the auto bailout for President Obama. So he tweeted out this statistic looking at, you know, the big thing was this pre-existing condition. And a couple of Upton and others went in and said they got this $8 billion fund to help with pre-existing conditions. Well, Ratner put this out, and it looks as if it's from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, whatever that is. Under this plan, if you have, let's pick one, diabetes, without a complication as a pre-existing condition, your insurance will go up $5,600 a year. If you have, what's the next one, rheumatoid arthritis with autoimmune disorders, $26,000. Pregnancy, your insurance will go up $17,000. So, okay, you can get coverage, but who's gonna be able to afford that?
Every stakeholder, the AMA, the AARP, all these groups that have a strong interest in healthcare, they're all against this bill. I've seen this incredible list of organizations that have said this is a bad idea.
Can I ask you guys a question, too, that's sort of related and sort of unrelated to this? There was a story in the Tribune about a guy who was at the Trump Tower, had a $1,300 bill, didn't pay it because he said he doesn't like Donald Trump. He was drunk, too, and he's a jerk. Are you surprised that there have not been more acts of retaliation against Donald Trump or the administration at
Mar-a-Lago? At his properties?
Every time I go up and down, I often walk or jog up and down the riverfront here. It's such an easy target, if you will.
There's something I was just reading before I came in here, that there's someone's trying to get approval to float pigs.
Yo, that was a while ago. Yeah, right.
He's actually launching the Kickstarter campaign. It's $250,000, and he wants to have big gold inflatable pigs that will float in front of the Trump
letters.
Name.
And they're going to let him, if he gets the money, do that? It's a work of art, I know, but really? I mean, would you allow that, Eric, if
no,
you were in charge of that?
I would not allow that.
Really?
No, I know you're an artist, Scott. I'm offending your artistic sensibilities, but no, you can't do that.
Yeah. So John Dickerson had Donald Trump on Face the Nation, and at one point the president just dismissed him because Dickerson wouldn't let this one question go about his tweet about Obama.
Obama
saying that he was
sick
and bad.
I stand by nothing.
And so he would not be cornered on an answer on that. And finally he just walked away and dismissed him and sat back down at his desk. Colbert comes on his show and he says that
Dickerson has too much integrity to insult back at the president after he essentially insulted him by just dismissing him and walking
away. He also called his program Deface the Nation. I mean, that was another
thing.
And
he said he deserves better than that. So then Colbert says, I don't have so much respect or integrity. And then he unleashed a barrage of insults, some of which is pretty profane language that they bleeped. I bring this up because of how do you treat the Trump sign? It's the president. I don't know how we manage the decorum here, but I think Colbert did cross a line.
And that's the example of what I was saying earlier about this sort of extra level. You know, it's not Republican or Democrat. Could you ever imagine a president of the United States in an interview with someone belittling the name of his show? I mean, it's just crazy.
Mocking him to his face.
He said he regretted some of the words that he used, but he didn't regret the idea of insulting Trump like that. He said, well, I'm a comedian and he's got the nuclear launch code. So, you know, I think he'll be
fair
all right.
Fight. Yeah.
He'll be okay. The Jimmy Kimmel thing, we didn't mention that. Did anyone think that that
I cried.
Was important?
I tear up every time.
I thought it was one of the most remarkable television monologues I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, I did too. And I thought that it did have the potential, I thought, to change some thinking on the healthcare debate.
I mean, I think he moved the country in many ways on that. And I think he said it in such a succinct, heartfelt way. I mean, man.
I think a lot of people saw it as inappropriate. And I'm not,
really?
Yeah, I do. Because he's talking about his child who was born with a congenital heart defect, right?
Am
I
yep.
getting that correct?
Yeah.
And that, and then all of a sudden dovetails into we have to have health care for all and Trump is awful. And it just seemed...
He didn't say that. He actually blamed the Democrats and Republicans, which I thought was kind of strange. But all he said was, like, if your kid is sick, you should never have to worry about whether you can afford to save his life.
I think he was talking – specific to pre-existing conditions again, right? Wasn't it?
Opened that part up, though, with – I want to say this. President Trump wanted to defund the National Institute of Health by a certain amount of money, and Congress didn't allow it, or they actually gave more money. But I think Scott's right. The takeaway from whatever his language was that he's not with Trump on his attitude on health care.
I mean, and I think to say that this, he's dovetailed from a very personal – touching tale to a political speech. And a lot of people were turned off on this. To think that it changed any minds is ridiculous, because that's exactly how it's being spun right now, is that the guys who disagree with what he was saying are going to continue to disagree with him. And the people who agree with him are going to be touched and moved and maybe strengthened in their support. Well, but I don't think it changed any minds.
Let the record show that Stant has just called me ridiculous. But I will counter that by saying Upton, this guy, is it Fred Upton, the Michigan congressman, very famously came out early in the week and said he would not vote for this bill because it didn't cover pre-existing conditions. He went to the White House and then got a promise, he and the guy from Missouri, that there would be more money for pre-existing conditions. I would argue that's evidence in my column that Kimmel built some support
okay.
for it.
The pre-existing condition thing is very important to a lot of people.
Your recommendations for the week then, Scott, you got one that you are especially liking?
I do. There's an internet comic called The Oatmeal, and it's a terrific, he's a remarkable guy who does it, but he comes up with an explanation of why we take political attacks personally and how they've done brain scans. It's much deeper than I'm describing it, but they've done brain scans to show how do you react when you say, he uses the example of George Washington's teeth. George Washington had wooden teeth, and you think, okay. George, but one set of his dentures were made out of the teeth of slaves, which is actually true. How do you react to that? If you're a great admirer of Washington, as I am, you get ticked. And that part of your brain is the same part of your brain that reacts when you're being physically attacked, which is fascinating. And if you read this piece, it gives context to why the political discussion today is so toxic.
Why we can't move one way or
the other. So theoatmeal.com.
All right, I'm going to indulge me a little bit here because for mine, I always struggle with what I'm going to suggest. And I have this song, it's a Johnny Cash song, that pops up on my Pandora like once every 6 months. And when it does, it stays with me for days. So it's a song called I Hung My Head. It's about that moment that I fear where you do one thing that doesn't really speak to the rest of your life, but you do one stupid thing and it ruins your life, right? So this song, I Hung My Head, is about a guy who's out on a hill, grabs his brother's gun, and he's out there aiming at things. He sees a guy on a horse, and before he thinks, he shoots him.
The sheriff, he asked me, why had I run? And then it came to me, just what I had done. And all for no reason, just one piece of lead. I hung my head. I hung my head.
That was recorded late in Johnny Cash's life, and the voice is there, and it just moves me every time I hear it.
Steve Bertrand and the gang from the Mincing Rascals. We always close the Mincing Rascals podcast with the recommendations from the gang, something that they are eating, drinking, reading, watching, or listening to. You can always hear the Mincing Rascals if you subscribe to it. It's the Mincing Rascals. We also post it at WGNradio.com. And one last political note. You've been probably following a little bit this news about what's been going on in France. They vote for their president tomorrow. And at the last second, before the people go to the polls, the more popular candidate declares that his email has been hacked. There's been a hack at the last minute. And we'll talk a little bit more about what they do in France after the news. But just think about this. The documents release, according to the USA Today, just before France enters a roughly two-day-long blackout, during which politicians, journalists, and even ordinary citizens are meant to pull back from public election talk to avoid swaying the vote, means that the leak may have very little impact. So they don't know if this leak of Emmanuel Macron's email is going to change the election or not. Maybe it did in the United States, right? But for 48 hours before the election, the politicians stop campaigning, the journalists there stop reporting on, and citizens are discouraged from even talking about the election for a couple of days before they vote. They're supposed to have a period of reflection where they then go to vote on Sunday. Do you like that idea? Don't you think we would? I love that idea. And I think 2 days is not long enough. Not only is our election too long, but we get too hysterical at the end. So I kind of like the idea of a buffer zone, and I kind of like the idea of a shorter run. But I'll ask you what you make of the idea of a buffer zone just before the election, and how long should it be if we do that here in America? One last note about the French election. They had, I didn't follow this, but I saw this week, they had a petition drive in France to get Barack Obama to run for president, and it got 50,000 signatures. They said, look, we know you're not busy. You can't run for president of America again. He's still a very popular candidate over there, or person over there, and 50,000 people wanted him to be the candidate. It's 11:31. Thank you, Veronica.
This old dog ain't about to forget. All we've had, and all that's next. Long as my heart's beating in my chest. This old dog ain't about to forget.
It's our Vibe Scored segment. It's where we ask Griffin to tap into something's going on in the world. We'll feed you if you have the Vibe Score app. It's a free app I developed with my cousin Tom Hegberg. You can get the Vibe Score app. We'll feed you videos, songs, and stories that are of interest to you. And then we ask you a scoreable question at the end of each post. So that's the musical vibe for the weekend. And Griffin, you need to tell us who that is and what we were listening to, and then we'll vibe on it.
Yeah, it was Mac DeMarco, Canadian singer-songwriter. Back with a new album that just came out yesterday called This Old Dog. That was the title track.
Yeah, it was a really good song. Oh, boy.
You're not the only one that feels that way. Sorry. I find him to be a divisive figure.
Did I miss something?
In rock right now, some people find him super endearing, think he's very sweet, laid back, charming, and funny.
Yeah.
That was one of his slower songs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're vibing that song. If he doesn't pick up the pace here, I'm not going to give him a very good number.
Wow, okay.
I'm going to give that song a 71. 71 vibe score.
I always love when you have the just coldest review and then, you know.
And they give it a pretty good number.
Give it in the 70s, yeah.
In my world, 71 is a low score.
I guess so.
That's like a C minus.
See, because I'm not that much higher than you. I'd probably give it an 80, but I like the song. I think it's good.
Where are you, Veronica?
I'm thinking about a 50.
And by the way, Veronica gives everything a terrible.
I do. I am very picky about music. I need energy in music. So if
I actually remembered that as I was selecting the song, I clicked it and
slow,
I remembered you say that some about some other song.
I'm going to always give it a terrible score if it's slow and if it's too poppy. I'm not a big fan of pop music, so I'm probably going to give it a...
Well, what do you want, lady?
Some classical.
What can we get you here?
Give me some rock and roll, man.
Rock and roll. All right, get a Bruce Springsteen song, or I don't know what your cup of tea is, but we'll crank something out for you next week.
Okay.
What do you got for us, Griff?
Well, the Kentucky Derby is later today.
Yeah.
We've narrowed... Vibe Score only gives you two choices, right? I wanted to ask, what's your favorite name of any of these horses? Because none of us really knows what we're talking about with horse racing.
No.
But we know when we see a good name, a name that we like.
Right.
But, you know, we have to narrow it down to two. So that's what I did.
You picked two of the names that are running and said which of these is the best.
I used my editorial powers to decide which were the finalists.
Okay.
And maybe people will be upset with that decision, but I'm going with...
What have you got?
I like Hence and Gervin. Are you? I mean,
I did look at the names. I actually this week looked at the names because horse names are fun. So I think this is inspired, but and I did think Hence was my favorite.
Hence is a good one.
Hence is awesome because when do you use Hence? It's the name of a horse. That's awesome.
And there's some like energy to it. It's like I'm coming. Hence. And Gervin, I just like because it's not trying at all. It doesn't care what you think.
What's the name of the horse with one eye?
Well, everybody likes Patch.
Now, Patch is good. But...
Patch. Okay, I'm going to go with Patch just because he's the underdog.
Have
can't
you not
see.
Been listening? That's not an option in this question.
Well, no, but we can go through some of the others. Maybe I can go back in and change our two finalists.
Or you can make a new question, but what are the other names you
Patch
like?
Patch is a little on the nose for me. Or on the eye, I guess. But... Looking at Lee, you know, there's a story there that I don't know, so pass.
That's the great thing about some of these. You go, there's something behind that, so that's kind of cool. Looking at Lee.
Yeah, but we don't, you know, okay. Unless I'm going to go do some reading. And God forbid we do that. Thundersnow. Okay, that's pretty good. Fast and Accurate. Untrapped. Always Dreaming, I guess, is the front runner, is what we've heard.
Always Dreaming, to me, is the name of a boat. It's not a horse name. Keep going. I'll pass. That, I do not like that for a horse.
State
name.
Of Honor.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Gervin.
Gervin.
Come on, Gervin.
And you like Gervin just because it's not trying, because that's such a nondescript, that you know nothing about this horse with the name Gervin.
What I read was that it's the name of a town in Texas.
Fine.
Oh, it sounds kind of like a nerdy name. Kind of.
Yeah,
if
right.
If you were a guy with the name Gervin, people would beat you up.
I picture like a horse with a pocket protector somehow. I don't know where you put it, but.
Well, then all the more reason to me. Now I like Gervin.
There you go.
Gervin's my boy.
Irish War Cry. I saw a list from, I can't remember who, but they put Irish War Cry at the top. And I thought, I don't. Come on.
Well, that's a pretty. Wah, here we come. Charge. Yeah. With an accent, with a brogue, you know.
And then there's others, you know. I mean, McCracken, Classic Empire, Practical Joke. It goes on.
But okay, but you've selected for us. We need to choose from...
Hence and Gervin.
I'm still going to go with Hence. God bless you, Gervin, but I'm going with Hence.
Fair enough. Veronica?
I'm going to go with Gervin.
Oh, but you also, you picked something else.
Yeah. Patch, just because I think it's
an adorable
cool.
story. Yeah. The one-eyed horse. Who cannot root for the one? Isn't that like a children's book, Patch, the one-eyed horse?
We had a call from Scott earlier when you were talking about Patch, and you were wondering if he could see the other horses because of his
eye. He's missing an eye, and if he's on the outside coming around, how does he see the other horses?
Right. Scott said that won't be a problem. He'll be in last. He'll see them all right in front of him, which was cold.
Cold.
I didn't say it.
Oh, you're hating on a one-eyed horsey. Come on.
He said it. Moving on, I guess. In movies, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 came out yesterday. I saw it.
Oh, no kidding. How is it?
I really liked it. I usually don't like these. It's another Marvel movie, another superhero movie. I find them all very boring by now, and I begrudgingly went to this one. I don't know why. Why do I do anything anymore? But I thought it was really funny, and I've actually been surprised at the mixed reactions that I've been seeing from critics. Michael Phillips in the Tribune gave it 2.5 stars. I'd go higher than that.
Okay.
I thought it was really fun. Any movie, every movie is too long. If you, any movie gets better if you shave 15 minutes off of it.
I think
guaranteed.
You're right about
it. Well, that's definitely the case here.
That is sure true for Broadway shows. You go see a musical in town, it's always over 2 hours by the time you get out of there. And there's always a scene where you go, we really know what's happening. We don't need this song.
And that's totally true here. I was getting antsy by the end. But I still had a good time. And there's like one too many pop culture references, 80s specific, and that's kind of a part of this franchise. And it's enough already at a certain point. But Other than that, I thought it was really fun, really funny. And related to that, we've got a question in the celebrities category, which is the star of that movie, Chris Pratt, got really fit, like, you know, really ripped up to do the first one, to be an action hero. But he wasn't always that way. If you are a fan of his from Parks and Recreation, he was kind of chubbier. I mean, chubby might be too strong a language, but he was doughy. Like, lovable, doughy, big, fun guy. Kind of like the baseball players you're talking
about. Kyle Schwarber.
Yeah, Kyle Schwarber. Like, big, fun. How that article described you should be. So we pitted the two Chris Pratts against each other.
And you get to pick one?
Yeah, do you prefer him ripped up like he is now?
Oh.
In Jurassic World and Passengers, all these new, like, big action movies he's doing. Or do you like the
more approachable,
the puppy dog Chris Pratt?
Yeah.
And to me, it's no question.
It's no question. It's
the former. One. Yeah. Or, yeah. The so, previous Chris Pratt.
Sorry, Mr. Pratt, if you're listening, but the doughy version of you is our favorite.
I think he'd be happy to hear it.
Had he known, he wouldn't have spent all that time in the gym. You know?
Yeah. Here he was on the rack throwing weights around going, boy, I hope this works for Griffin.
I know. I missed a call from him the day before he started. I'll always regret it.
Well, I don't know, Griff. I think I'll just take the female side on this one and vote for the ripped version.
I think
of
that's
him.
Fair. I think that deserves to be.
Well, we have a female handy. Oh, Veronica, which version of Chris Pratt do you prefer?
Well, if we could kind of combine the two, have a puppy dog look with the muscles.
Right. That'd be the best of both worlds.
Yeah. But, I think he seems more like a real person with, you know, before.
Before, yeah. Wow. Fair enough. Give me one more, Griff.
What else do we got? Okay, so, well, in Chicago sports, Kyle Schwarber is batting leadoff for the Cubs, and through early May, he was hitting under 200.
What do you make of Schwarby hitting in the leadoff spot? Schwarber is your leadoff hitter. 100, you think it's perfect, keep him there. And 0 is, no, he's got a bat later in the lineup. We've also got a question about the idea that they're doing in France. This is how they do it. A buffer time before you vote. A 2-day at least span where there's no political campaigning, reporting, or conversation. You think that's a great idea? That's one of the questions you get to respond to on VibeScore. 11:49, let's make it 11:50 now. In fact, just for the fun of it, let's take a couple calls on that. 312-981-7200. So the big vote's tomorrow in France, and if you go to France today, the journalists are not reporting on it, and the people are supposed to not be talking about it. And what's the other angle? And the politicians themselves are not supposed to be campaigning on it. I presume that the commercials are not running right now in France. Can you imagine in the run-up to the last presidential election here? And by the way, it's just like that there. They've got a hack in the 11th hour. It's been a very mean-spirited one with a debate that was crazy on TV the other day, and you've got a far right-wing candidate and then a more populist one or more centrist one. So I'm wondering, do you like the idea that we would take a break before the election and that we just go quiet? And we would be talking about, on this radio station, for instance, we'd be talking, God, that would be weird, because everybody want to be talking about it, but we'd be talking about the Cubs or, you know, transportation. I don't know what we'd be talking about. I literally don't know what we'd be talking about. But maybe that's a reminder to us that we should figure that out, too. Okay, give me a call, 312-981-7200. By the way, speaking of politics real quick, did you see Sneed in the Sun-Times this week? Oh, my, do tell. Former President Barack Obama lived with and loved another woman in Chicago and proposed to her before he met the country's future First Lady, Michelle Obama. According to a massive new biography titled Rising Star by David Garrow. Whoa, her name was Sheila Jaeger, J-A-G-E-R, who is now a professor at Oberlin College. Her story in the book, Jaeger describes their personal trajectory, life together as an island unto ourselves, a marriage proposal in late 1986. Her response, not yet, because her parents felt she was too young. Jaeger, sensing Barack's sudden ambitions in 87 when he was 25 and his sense of destiny. And then Barack met Michelle and the rest is history. I didn't know that story. But I'd heard about the book. It's 1,460 pages long. It'll cost you $45 if you buy the hardback version, which is just out. I'm trying to get a copy myself, and we'll see if David Guerra wants to come in our studio when he travels to Chicago. But I don't know that I will have read it by then, or ever. Here is the start of the review in the New York Times for Rising Star, The Making of Barack Obama. Rising Star, the voluminous 1,460-page biography of Barack Obama by David Guerra, is a dreary slog of a read, a bloated, tedious, and given its highly intemperate epilogue, ill-considered book that is in desperate need of editing and way more exhausting than it is exhaustive. Ouch! I always feel bad for people. I mean, the review is what it is. The guy didn't like the book. In fact, he rips this book. But can you? I always come to this place, though, when after a year of making a movie or years of writing a book, you finally drop it in front of somebody and they say, nah, it sucks. I always feel so bad for that person. I mean, the New York Times book review is the one you kind of wait for. And you've been working on this for years and you've written 1,460 pages. And they say it's tedious, bloated, needs an editor, and is exhausting. What a hard day for that guy. It's 11:57.